I've hardly spoken a word all evening. Is something the matter?
No, nothing particular.
Things going badly?
Not frightfully well. It's a bad time of year.
Don't be idiotic. One time of year is as good as any other for a dentist. Are people cancelling their appointments because...
Because they don't want to sit in a dentist's chair and be practiced on by somebody who might be a murderer? Half of them are scared stiff of going to the dentist at the best of times, and now...
Oh, it's so unfair. It makes me feel so guilty.
Well, why should you feel guilty?
Because I've become quite a draw at Antoine's. Everybody wants me to do their hair so they can hear about the murder at first hand. I've even talked Antoine into raising my wages.
Whereas, as far as I'm concerned, if things go on like this, I shall have to pack it all in and emigrate to Canada or somewhere.
I'm sure it won't really come to that.
I feel so much at the mercy of things. If I were a young man in a book, I'd get down to finding out which of the passengers on the plane really did the murder.
Well, now's your chance. One of them sitting over there in the corner by himself. Don't turn round, I don't want him to notice us.
Who is it?
It's Mr. Clancy, the man who writes detective stories. Why don't we follow him when he leaves? You never know, he might find out something.
How far's he got with his dinner?
He's about level with us. And we'd better get a move on so we can leave immediately after he does. We mustn't draw attention to ourselves.
What the devil's he up to? He keeps stopping and starting and changing direction. Is he trying to throw us off the scent, do you think?
I don't believe he's actually noticed us at all. Oh, he's stopped again. Why is he looking at the butcher's shop?
He seems to be chattering away to himself. What's the matter with him?
And off he goes again.
He's certainly getting a move on. I'm going to have a job keeping up with him without being noticed.
He stopped. He seems to be looking for something. It's keys. He's going in.
47 Cardigan Street. That's the address he gave for himself at the inquest.
Yes.
Fine evening for the chase, is it not?
Monsieur Poirot, are you still trying to clear your character?
Ah, you remember our little conversation? And are you playing at detectives? Is it the ingenious Mr. Clancy that you suspect? Oh,
so do you, or you wouldn't be here.
Ah, no, mademoiselle. No, there are more important things than finding the murderer. The vital point is to clear the innocent. But why should we not combine together? I am about to call on Mr. Clancy. Now, I would suggest that you, mademoiselle, accompany me in the guise of a secretary. Here, take this notebook and pencil for the shorthand.
But I can't write shorthand.
You can make signs on the paper, can you not? As for you, Mr. Gale, I suggest that you meet us upstairs at Monseigneur's in an hour's time.
Very well.
Come then, mademoiselle.
Murder, and to be part of it oneself, it's simply amazing. All very shocking, of course, but undoubtedly rather thrilling. I'm writing the whole thing just as it happened, only as fiction, of course, with pen portraits of all the passengers. The airmail mystery, it ought to sell like wildfire.
Won't you be had up for libel or something?
Oh, no, dear lady. My story is far too ingenious for that.
And it is because of your ingenuity, Monsieur Clancy, that I have come to see you. It would be of great interest to me to know who, in your opinion, committed the crime.
Well, of course, I'm very flattered. But a real murder is very different from my little mysteries. You haven't any control over the facts.
No, but if you had to make a sporting guess... Who would you choose?
Well, I suppose one of the two Frenchmen.
Ah, why is that?
Well, she was French. Seems more likely somehow. And they were sitting on the opposite side, not far away from her. But really, oh, I don't know.
It depends so much on motive.
Yes. I gather there's a daughter who comes into Madame Giselle's money. And there might be people on board who owed her money and couldn't afford to pay her back.
True. And there are other possibilities. Let us suppose that Madame Giselle knew of something, attempted murder, shall we say, on the part of one of these people.
Attempted murder? What a very curious suggestion.
In a case like this one, one must think of everything. That blowpipe that you bought.
Oh, I wish I'd never mentioned that blasted thing.
I think you mentioned you bought it in the Charing Cross Road. Do you remember by any chance the name of the shop?
Well, it might have been Mitchell and Smith. Oh, and then again, it might have been Houghton and Mann.
Perhaps, Miss Gray, you would be so obliging as to take down those two names.
Yes, Monsieur Poirot.
And now, Mr. Clancy, we must take our departure.
Oh, well, you came at a fortunate moment. For days, I've been racking my brains for the name of the criminal in my story. And just now, I saw it written up above a butcher's shop. Pargiter. Oh, but you must allow me to give you a copy of The Case of the Scarlet Petal. It deals in some detail with arrow poisons. Here you are.
Ah, you are too amiable, monsieur.
Oh, not at all. I notice, Miss Gray, that you don't use the Pickman system of shorthand.
No. Miss Gray uses a much more efficient system recently devised in Czechoslovakia.
You don't say.
I do.
Very clever, those Czechs. Pilsen beer, glass, gloves, and now a new shorthand system. I'm sorry I couldn't be more helpful. I hope you find your blowpipe.
So, did you get anything out of Mr. Clancy?
He's not so scatterbrained as one might imagine.
He saw through me, all right. Did you really want those addresses?
I think they might be useful, yes.
And are you going to go through this process with all the passengers on the plane?
Oh, yes. It is part of my order and method. But I could perhaps solve the problem more quickly if I had help.
What kind of help?
Well, help from you, Mr. Gale, and later perhaps from you too, Miss Gray.
What can I do?
You will not like it.
Let me be the judge of that. What is it?
Frankly, what I need is a blackmailer.
A blackmailer? What for?
Oh, to blackmail. What else?
Who am I to blackmail?
You will write... No, I will write a note and you will copy it to the Countess of Horbury.
The lady who was sitting across the gangway from us?
The same. In this note, you will ask for an interview. You will refer to certain business dealings of Madame Giselle having passed into your hands.
And then?
You will be accorded an interview. You will say certain things in which I will instruct you, and you will ask for £10,000.
You're mad.
No, not at all. I am eccentric, possibly, but mad, no.
What if she sends for the police?
She will not send for the police.
You can't know that.
Oh, mon cher, practically speaking, I know everything.
I don't like the idea of blackmailing a woman.
Ah, you have the chivalrous spirit. But I assure you that Lady Hopiore is not worth the fine feelings. She is, to use your idiom, a nasty piece of goods.
All the same...
All you have to do is to produce a certain effect. After that, the ground is prepared, and I can step in.
All right, I'll do it. But I don't like it.
Good. Now, take this down. This is what you will write. To the Countess of Horbury.
Dear Madam, Madame Giselle, deceased. I am the holder of certain documents formerly in her possession. If you or Mr. Raymond Barraclough are interested in the matter, I should be happy to call on you. Or perhaps you would prefer me to deal directly with your husband. Yours truly, John Robinson.
Well, will I do?
Oh, nom de Dieu, what kind of comedy do you think you are playing?
I thought you said it would be as well if I wore a slight disguise.
A slight disguise? What do you think you are? A Guy Fawkes to go on top of the bonfire? A false beard that cries out to heaven and those ridiculous eyebrows? My friend, this is certainly not your métier.
I acted in amateur theatricals a great deal at one time.
No, mon ami, you are to be a blackmailer, not a comedian. I want her ladyship to fear you, not die of laughing the moment she sees you. Now, let me take a hand. This is a serious business. And let me be certain that you know your lines.
There's no need to go into details, Lady Horbury. We all know how pleasant a few days on the Riviera can be, but husbands seldom agree.
I don't need to tell you what the evidence consists of. Giselle always came up with the goods. The question is, who needs it most? You or Lord Horbury?
How did you get hold of this so-called evidence?
Now, really, Lady Horbury, that's rather beside the point.
Show it to me.
No, I'm not so green as that. If we agree to do business, of course, that's another matter. I'll show you the stuff before you hand the money over.
How much do you want?
10,000. Pounds, not dollars.
I could never lay my hands on anything like that amount.
Oh, it's wonderful what you can do when you try. Jewels aren't fetching what they did, but pearls are still pearls.
Oh, it's no good. I can't get that kind of money.
Well, in that case, it's only right that Lord Horbury should know what's been going on. And I believe I'm right in saying that a woman who loses a divorce case on account of her adultery doesn't get any money. And that Raymond Barraclough, who you're having such a merry time with in those pictures in the papers, may have a very pretty face, but he isn't exactly rolling in it, is he? I'll leave you to think it over.
What is it?
Monsieur Poirot is here to see you, your ladyship.
Oh, who is he? What does he want?
He said he was here at the request of Mr. Barraclough, my lady.
Then you better show him in, but give me a moment, will you?
Madame, I entreat you to look on me as a friend. You are, I know, in great trouble.
Oh, I don't know what
you're... Écoutez, I do not ask you to give away your secrets. I know beforehand. That is the essence of being a good detective.
A detective? Of course you were on the plane.
Now, let us get down to business. A little while ago, you had a visitor. His name was Brown, perhaps.
Robinson.
Well, it is the same thing. He came here to blackmail you. He has in his possession certain proofs of an indiscretion, proofs that were once in the possession of Madame Giselle. He offers them to you for perhaps 8,000 pounds.
10.
And you will not find it easy to get that amount quickly.
Oh, I can't get it at all. I'm already heavily in debt.
Calm yourself. Place yourself in my hands. I will deal with this Mr. Robinson.
And how much will you require for your services?
Oh, I ask only that you tell me the whole truth about this business.
And you will get me out of this mess?
You will never hear of Mr. Robinson again.
All right. I'll tell you everything. I began borrowing from that Giselle woman 18 months ago. I was in a hole.
Gambling?
And other things. I had an appalling run of luck.
Who sent you to her?
Well, Raymond, Mr. Barraclough, told me he'd heard she lent money to society women.
And she lent you as much as you wanted?
Not at first, but then she began to lend me more.
And I gather that you and Mr. Barraclough had become friends?
Yes.
But you were anxious your husband should not know about it.
Stephen's tired of me. He'd have jumped at the chance of a divorce. He wants to marry somebody else.
But you did not want a divorce.
Well, no, you see, I...
You liked your position as Lady Horbury too much, and the use of your husband's ample income.
It wasn't enough, but I couldn't ask him for more.
And you could not repay Madame Giselle?
No, I couldn't.
So her death was quite providential.
Well, it seemed too wonderful. I simply couldn't believe it.
But it made you a little nervous, did it not? You alone of the passengers on that plane had a motive for wanting her dead.
Yes, I was in quite a state about it.
Especially since you had been to see her in Paris the night before and had something of a scene with her.
Well, she wouldn't budge an inch. I think she actually enjoyed it.
And yet you said at the inquest you had never seen her before.
Well, what else could I say? But I felt pretty safe even when that dreadful inspector kept badgering me with questions. And then that awful letter came and I was afraid.
Afraid of exposure? Or of being arrested for murder.
But I didn't kill her. You know I didn't. I never moved from my seat.
Mm-hmm. I believe you, madame, for two reasons. First, because of your sex, and secondly, because of a wasp.
A wasp?
But that does not make sense to you. Well, let us attend to the matter in hand. I will deal with Mr. Robinson, but in return for my services, I will ask you two little questions. Was Mr. Barraclough in Paris the day before the murder?
Yes, we dined together, but he thought it better that I should see Madame Giselle alone.
And one further question. You were on the stage, I believe, before you were married, and called yourself Cicely Bland. Was that your real name?
No. My real name was Martha Jebb.
And you were born where?
Doncaster. But why do you...
Oh, mere curiosity.
To tell you the truth, Poirot, I'm not very happy at all about the way this case is going. Mm. The more I look into things, the less I get. If only we could come up with a single clue.
I will give you three. And I will give them titles like the names of Mr. Clancy's stories. The Clue of the Wasp, The Clue of the Passenger's Baggage, The Clue of the Extra Coffee Spoon.
You're potty, old fruit. What's all this about a coffee spoon?
I questioned one of the stewards. He remembered noticing two spoons on a Madame Giselle's saucer.
That's supposed to mean a wedding.
In this case, my friend, it meant a funeral.
Is that Monsieur Hercule Poirot?
Speaking.
I have a call for you from Paris, Monsieur Fournier.
Pray be so good as to put him through at once.
Go ahead, caller.
Monsieur Poirot, it is most important that you come to Paris straight away. Can you be at my office by 2 o'clock tomorrow? The daughter of Madame Giselle has come to claim her inheritance.
It was the event for which I had been waiting. The entry on the scene of the shadowy figure of whose presence I had been conscious all along. Now, very soon, all would be made clear. But this time, I did not feel inclined to trust my stomach to the hazards of the air. I travelled by the boat train, taking with me, once again as my secretary, Miss Jane Grey.
It couldn't have come at a better time, really. I've been given the push.
The push, mademoiselle?
I had a row with Antoine. I lost my temper with a customer.
Oh.
She really was an absolute cow. I was feeling nervy and I just let rip and told her what I thought of her. I ought to be looking round for a new job, I suppose, but I couldn't resist your offer of a few days in Paris.
And the good Mr. Gale, he has no objections?
Why should he? He doesn't own me. He's much too concerned with trying to make up his mind whether to move to Canada or New Zealand. But what's all this about? Do you want me to trail around and do my phony shorthand act?
No, the object of my journey is to meet the daughter of Madame Giselle. Oh. But I wish also to speak further with the Duponts. Now, perhaps while I am taking on the father, I will leave the son to you. You remember him from the inquest, I imagine?
I've seen him since then. I ran into him at Lyons Corner House.
Ah, excellent. Better and better. But listen carefully. I do not want you to tell him about the daughter of Madame Giselle. It might be as well if, without actually saying it, you could convey the impression that Lady Horbury is suspected of the crime.
You don't think he did it, do you?
No, he is not exactly top of my list, but I am keeping open all my options until I have encountered this mysterious figure who is about to step into the limelight.
She has gone to check into the Hotel Madeleine, but she should be back here at any moment. I've only had the chance to have a few words with her.
What age is Mademoiselle Morisot?
Ah, but she is not Mademoiselle Morisot. She is Mrs. Richards, married and 24 years old, according to her birth certificate, which she brought with her to establish her identity. She is the daughter of Georges Liman and Madame Morisot, both of Quebec.
Quebec? That should throw a certain light on the early life of Madame Giselle.
As far as I can piece it out, Marie Morisot was a nursery governess when she met this Georges Liman. They married, but after the child was born, they went their separate ways. Marie Morisot to France, and I have no idea what became of Liman. The child was left with the Institut de Marie. Madame Morisot sent money for her daughter from time to time, and then a lump sum, which was to be given to her when she reached the age of 21.
And how did Anne Morisot come to hear of her mother's death and her inheritance?
We inserted discreet advertisements in various journals. One of these came to the notice of the principal of the Institut de Marie, who telegraphed to Mrs. Richards, who was then working in Europe.
Mm-hmm. And who is this Richards, the girl's husband?
I gather he comes from Detroit. He is a maker of surgical instruments.
She did not accompany his wife?
No, he is still in America.
And is Mrs. Richards able to throw any light on the reason for her mother's murder?
She knows nothing whatsoever about her, apart from the few facts given to her by the principal of the Institut de Marie. Ah, but she is here. Please, show Mrs. Richards in. Ah, madame, allow me to present Monsieur Hercule Poirot, who is kindly helping the police in their investigation into your mother's death.
I am pleased to make your acquaintance, monsieur. Though my feelings in this matter are hardly those of a daughter. To all intents and purposes, I have been an orphan all my life. The head of the Institut, Mère Angélique, is the nearest I have had to a mother.
And you left the Institut when, madame?
When I was 18. I worked for a time as a manicurist and then in a dressmaker's shop.
Mm-hmm. And when did you meet your husband?
A little over a year ago. I was in Nice, and he was about to return to America. He came over again on business to Holland, and we were married in Amsterdam a month ago. He has already gone back home, and now I am about to join him there.
And the first you heard of the tragedy was from Mère Angélique?
Oh, no, I read about it in the papers, but I had no idea the victim was my mother. Then I received a telegram from the Institut de Marie, and I presented myself here. I'm very happy to answer your questions, monsieur, but I do not really see how I can help you. After all, I never knew my mother.
You are disappointed, mon vieux. You had some idea about that girl. Did you suspect, perhaps, that she might be an imposter?
No, I never thought that. And the young lady seems genuine enough. It is odd, though. I feel that I have met her before. But no matter. She has no light to shed on the mystery, and it all makes less and less sense. I must put through a call to Quebec.
Well, did you have any luck?
A little. I spoke with Mère Angélique at the Institut de Marie, and she confirmed all that Mrs. Richards told us about her upbringing there. Madame Giselle seemed to think that it was better for the child to grow up away from her influence.
But how did Mrs. Richards come to be in Nice? It's rather an unlikely place for a good little convent girl.
Apparently, she had a job as a lady's maid, and she came to Europe in that capacity.
And what about her father? What happened to him?
Oh, that was the main reason for my telephone call. He was an obvious suspect. But he was killed in the early days of the war. There was something I was saying a moment ago, something that...
Please excuse me. I'm still listening. It's just... I've got a jagged nail. I need to find a nail file.
Ha! Nom du nom du nom!
What's the matter?
I remember now why the face of Anne Richard seemed familiar to me. She was in the aeroplane on the day of the murder.
Huh?
Lady Horbury sent for her to get a nail file. Anne Richards was Lady Horbury's maid. Oh, please, mademoiselle, will you telephone Monsieur Fournier and ask him to come here straight away? This changes everything.
But why did no one mention this before? Why was she not included among the suspect persons?
Because she was not on the passenger list.
Oh.
I have spoken to Lady Horbury, who says that her maid usually travel by rail and boat. It was only at the last moment that she decided that she should accompany her.
But where was she during the flight?
In the front part of the aeroplane.
Yes, I remember now. Lady Horbury sent for her just after the plane had taken off. She didn't appear again.
Where did she go for the nail file? Do you remember, mademoiselle?
To where the coats and cases were, at the rear of the plane.
Past where Madame Giselle was sitting. The poison must have had a delayed effect.
But it is not possible. Oh, can all my ideas have been entirely wrong?
Oh, mon vieux, such things happen. They happen to me.
They do not happen to me. But it does not make sense. If it was only arranged for her to travel on the plane at the last minute, how could she have known that her mother would be a passenger? Oh, mon Dieu.
What is it? What's the matter?
I was not wrong. I am sure of it. And if that is so, then Anne Richards is in imminent danger. I must go to her hotel immediately. Will you have the goodness to remain here, mademoiselle, in case there is any further news?
Yes.
Come, mon ami. There is not a second to lose.
What is it, Monsieur Poirot? What has happened? Did you find her?
Life is very terrible, mademoiselle.
What do you mean?
When we reached the hotel, we were told that she had left with an American for the Gare du Nord.
An American?
She was surprised to see him, it seems. He put her in a taxi, but did not go with her. He said something about the boat train.
But did they find her?
Oh, yes. When the train reached Boulogne, she was slumped across her seat with a little blue bottle in her hand. It had contained prussic acid.
You mean she killed herself?
Oh, that is what the police think.
What will you do now?
I shall return to England tomorrow. But I would prefer you to remain in Paris, if you will. There are various tasks that you could perform for me, and I would still like you to talk to Jean Dupont.
Oh, that's already arranged. We're having dinner together tomorrow night.
Oh, excellent. And do not feel you have to hasten your return. Stay in Paris for as long as you wish.
Well, old cock, trouble certainly seems to follow you about. What happened? Did the girl kill her mother and then poison herself out of remorse?
That is the official view.
But not yours, eh?
There are a few little matters which I would be greatly obliged if you could look into.
Always ready to oblige.
And I would like you to dine with me in 2 days' time. Mr. Clancy will be coming, and Mr. Gale also. I think we should have a very interesting evening.
This really is an honour, Monsieur Poirot, to have a demonstration of what I might call your methods at first hand.
And with a first-rate dinner thrown in?
Mm. Oh, you can always count on Monsieur Poirot for a good meal. It helps to sustain you through what follows.
My friends, I will start at the beginning. I will go back to the airliner Prometheus and its ill-fated flight from Le Bourget to Croydon.
See what I mean?
When, shortly before we were due to land, I suddenly awoke to find the steward asking Dr. Brandt to take a look at Madame Giselle, I had a feeling it might be something in my line. Whenever I come into contact with death, I am like the dog who lifts his head and sniffs the scent.
Oh, you've got a good nose for murder, all right.
At first, the cause of the poor woman's death seemed a complete mystery.
Didn't somebody suggest she might have been killed by a wasp? One of the French chaps said it had flown in his face and he'd swatted it.
And it was a perfectly plausible theory. There was a curious mark on the woman's neck. But at that moment I happened to look down and I saw what might have been the body of another wasp. In actuality it was a thorn with a piece of yellow and black silk attached to it. Mr. Clancy, of course, knew exactly what it was.
A poison thorn shot from a blowpipe in the manner of a native tribe.
By the time we reached Croydon, several ideas were working in my mind. Once I was on terra firma, my little grey cells began to work with all their natural brilliance.
Go it, Mr. Poirot. Don't let's have any false modesty.
I was struck by the audacity of the crime being committed in such a manner, and by the astonishing fact that nobody noticed it being done. There were two other points that interested me. One was the convenient presence of the wasp. The other was the discovery of the blowpipe.
Pushed down behind your own seat. Real cheeky, that was.
But why had the murderer not got rid of it by passing it through one of the ventilating holes in the windows?
Because perhaps he wanted it to be found.
But why? There could only be one logical answer. Because, in fact, the blowpipe had played no part in the crime.
But surely the poison dart was the cause of death. I mean, there's no doubt about that, is there?
Oh, no, no, the medical evidence confirmed that. So, I shut my eyes and asked myself, what is the surest way of placing a poison thorn in the jugular vein? And the answer came immediately. By hand.
So why did the murderer go through all the blowpipe business?
Because the blowpipe conveyed the suggestion of distance. If my theory was right, the person who killed Madame Giselle must have gone right up to her and bent over her.
That could only have been one of the stewards.
There was one other person. Mr. Clancy had passed immediately by Madame Giselle's seat, and it was he who had first drawn attention to the blowpipe theory.
This is monstrous. It's outrageous.
Sit down, Mr. Clancy. I have not finished. I am simply showing you the means by which I reached my conclusion. Next, I turned my attention to the wasp.
You had that wasp in your bonnet.
What was curious was that nobody had noticed it until after coffee had been served. It seemed that the murderer might be offering an alternative solution to the blowpipe, that Madame Giselle had been stung by a wasp and had succumbed to heart failure. But the success of that solution depended
on whether the killer could retrieve the poisoned thorn before anyone noticed what had happened. Mm-hmm. It could be done easily enough.
Was that why the silk attached to the thorn was yellow instead of cerise, so that it might resemble a wasp?
Bravo, Mr. Clancy. It was just that. Our killer approaches the victim's sable, presses the thorn into her neck, and releases the wasp.
But how could the murderer have done that? I mean, do you mean he was carrying the wasp in a box or something?
Which was why Monsieur Poirot was so interested in the contents of the passengers' pockets and their hand luggage.
And here I came up against a totally unexpected development. I found what I was looking for, but it was on the wrong person. There was an empty Bryant and Mays matchbox in Norman Gale's pocket. But by everyone's evidence, Mr. Gale had never passed down the gangway. He had only visited the toilet compartment, which was in the opposite direction from where Madame Giselle was sitting.
Well, at least that puts me in the clear.
Does it? There was a method by which Mr. Gale could have committed the crime, as the contents of his attaché case showed.
Don't even remember what was in it.
Oh, well, it can wait for a little. I am merely explaining my ideas about the crime. I now had two men who could have committed the crime, Mr. Clancy and Mr. Gale. But could I find a sufficiently convincing motive? And I confess I could not.
You always did make life difficult for yourself.
Of all the passengers on the plane, the only one who was undoubtedly mixed up with Madame Giselle and who would benefit by her death was Lady Horbury, and I did not see how she could have committed the crime.
But what about this daughter of Madame Giselle's? She stood to inherit a pretty tidy sum. Couldn't she have been one of the women on the plane?
The point did occur to me, Mr. Clancy. I ruled out Venetia Carr, and subsequently I was able to rule out Lady Horbury, but Jane Grey was another matter. I investigated her antecedents very carefully, and I satisfied myself that she was not the daughter of Madame Giselle.
And so you reached a series of dead ends?
So it seemed. And yet I was convinced that Mr. Gale was the murderer. There was the empty matchbox and the contents of the attaché case.
But what did I stand to gain from Madame Giselle's death? All that happened was that I lost most of my best patients.
I tried to gain Mr. Gale's confidence. I pretended to confide in him. I even persuaded him to help me in a fake blackmailing attempt on Lady Horbury. And it was there that he made his first mistake. I had suggested a modest disguise. He arrived to play his part with a makeup that was utterly ludicrous. No one could play a part as badly as he proposed to play that one. And there could only be one reason for this, that he did not wish to reveal how perfectly he could disguise himself, how well he could play a part.
But I don't understand. Why should he want to play a part?
Be patient, Monsieur Clancy. All will be explained. Because I was worried that Mademoiselle Jane was becoming too closely involved with Gale, I took her to Paris with me as my secretary, after Monsieur Fournier had told me that Anne Morisot was arriving to claim her fortune. The moment she walked into the room, I was convinced that I had seen her before, but I could not place her. And when I did, it was too late.
And where had you seen her before?
She was on the plane. And she was the maid of Lady Horbury. And when I discovered that, when I realized that she had lied, all my theories were overthrown. Here, overwhelmingly, was the guilty person. But then it became clear to me that she had not planned to be on the plane at all. She was there only as the result of a last-minute change of mind on the part of her mistress.
I can't make head nor tail of any of this.
I wouldn't let it worry you, Mr. Clancy.
So when did you give up on the idea that I was the murderer?
I did not give up. You are the murderer.
For
goodness sake, this is ridiculous.
Perhaps you would be so good as to reveal the result of your investigations, Chief Inspector.
Your name isn't Gale at all. You only called yourself that when you went into partnership as a dentist with your uncle, John Gale. You took his name, but you were his sister's son, not his brother's. Your real name is Richards.
It was as Richards that you met Anne Morisot at Nice last year when she was there with her mistress, Lady Hobury. Very quickly she became infatuated with you. You had her eating out of your hand. The story that she told us was not true. She did know her mother's maiden name, and she knew about her money-lending activity. She knew also that she might be heir to a vast fortune. From Anne you'd learned that Lady Hobury was a client of Giselle, and a plan began to form itself in your mind. Giselle was to be murdered in such a way as to throw suspicion on Lady Hobury.
You mean to say Anne Morisot knew all about it?
Oh, yes, yes. After all, did she not say that she never knew her mother? She and Gale met again in Nice this summer, and he began to put his plan into action. The clerk at Universal Airlines was bribed so that Giselle and Lady Hobury should travel on the same plane.
But surely it was taking an absurd risk if Anne Morisot was going to be there as well.
Ah, but as I told you, that was a decision taken only at the last moment by Lady Hobury, and that seriously jeopardized your plans, did it not, Mr. Gale? Your original idea was that Anne Morisot should claim the inheritance with a perfect alibi, since she would have been on the cross-channel ferry at the time of the murder. Later you would marry her, and the fortune would be yours. I imagine that for a moment when you saw her on the plane, your determination wavered, but you decided to go ahead nevertheless.
You're very clever with your ideas and your imagining, Monsieur Poirot. You ought to be in Mr. Clancy's profession. What you imagined, Monsieur Poirot, is hardly evidence.
Perhaps not. But then I do have a little evidence.
Oh, really? Well, then perhaps you can tell me how I managed to kill Madame Giselle when everyone who was on the plane knows perfectly well I never went near her.
I will tell you exactly how you committed the crime. And my evidence is in the contents of your dispatch case. You were on holiday. Why take with you a dentist's linen coat? That is what I asked myself. And the answer is that it closely resembled a steward's jacket.
What's that supposed to mean?
This is what it means. When coffee had been served and the stewards had gone to the front of the aeroplane, you went to the toilet, took your linen coat from the dispatch case, which you had carefully placed close by, padded your cheeks with cotton wool, came out, took a coffee spoon from the box in the pantry opposite, hurried down the gangway with the quick run of a steward, spoon in hand, to Madame Giselle's table. You thrust the thorn into her neck, opened the matchbox and let the wasp escape, creating a momentary diversion. You hurried back to the toilet, changed your coat, and strolled leisurely back to your seat. The whole thing took only a couple of minutes.
And what about Jane Grey? Do you suppose she wouldn't have noticed me capering about, pretending to be a steward?
I can tell you the answer to that. As soon as you got up, Miss Grey took out her powder compact and had a good look at herself in her hand mirror, and then she started to powder her nose and adjust her lipstick. Oh, the vanity of women.
That doesn't mean a thing. You can't prove a word of this.
A photograph of you has been transmitted to Rotterdam. It has been identified as that of a Mr. Richards who married Anne Morisot the week before she came forward to claim her inheritance.
So I married her. What does that prove?
You were playing a dangerous game. For over a year you had been planning to marry her in order to secure her inheritance from her mother, but in the meantime you had fallen very seriously in love with Jane Grey, and things were moving too fast for you. You heard that I had interviewed Anne Morisot, and you were worried that I might get the truth out of her. You hustled her out of her hotel and onto the boat train. You wanted to get rid of a woman who was already beginning to have second thoughts and to free yourself to marry Jane Grey. You forced prussic acid down your poor wife's throat and left the empty bottle in her hand.
You're making this up, every word.
You even left your fingerprints on the bottle.
That's impossible. I was wearing...
You were wearing gloves. I don't think we need here any more. James Richards, alias Norman Gale, I hold a warrant for your arrest on the charge of willful murder. I must warn you that anything you say will be taken down and used in evidence.
Monsieur Poirot, this has been absolutely the most thrilling experience of my life. I cannot thank you enough.
No, no, no. The good chap deserves as much credit as I do. He has done wonders in identifying Gale as Richards, who incidentally worked for 6 months on a snake farm in South Africa. The Canadian police are after Richards. A girl he was mixed up with there is supposed to have committed suicide, but facts have come to light which seem to point to murder.
Terrible.
A killer. And like so many killers, fatally attractive to women.
That poor girl, Jane Grey.
Yes, but she has courage. She will come through. And I trust she will find happiness with the young Dupont.
Can you be sure of that?
I have done everything in my power to make it sure. I have made a considerable contribution towards the Dupont's expedition to Persia, and I have arranged for Jane Grey to take part in it.
But will she go, do you think?
They left this morning. Archaeology has a way of bringing people together, and there are many consolations in digging up the past. It is a little like a detective story, but if you happen to dig up a corpse with the remains of a poisoned dart in its neck, it is a little too late to send for Hercule Poirot.
In Agatha Christie's Death in the Clouds, Hercule Poirot was played by John Moffat. Chief Inspector Japp, Philip Jackson. Monsieur Fournier, Geoffrey Whitehead. Daniel Clancy, Murray Melvin. Norman Gale, Ben Crow. Jane Grey, Teresa Gallagher. Lady Horbury, Carolyn Jones. Jean Dupont, Andrew Harrison. Dr. Bryant, Bruce Purchase. Elise Gandier, Liza Sadovy. Anne Richards, Priyanga Elan. The airline steward and agency clerk, Stephen Critchlow. Death in the Clouds was dramatized by Michael Bakewell. It was directed by Enid Williams for BBC Radio 4 and is published in the UK by BBC Worldwide.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.